Good morning, Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. Excited to be with you here, as always, every Wednesday morning, 7 to 9 a.m. It is October 29th, and man, was it a bit chilly out there on the way to, the office. Huh? To use the heated seats again? What the heck is this? You know, Halloween is coming up over here, and it's traditionally about the first night of the year. You've got to put on a jacket in the evening where you suddenly notice, ooh, this isn't what happened to this 2 weeks of fall we're supposed to have over here.
I hope your patio heaters are stocked up with gas cylinders.
I have been building patio heaters, man, for the last month in preparation for what this weekend is. Dozens and dozens of them, rebuilding igniters, thermocouplers. I mean, so many boring restaurant things over here. But Halloween gives us a lot of time to pause and reflect. Two of the restaurants I've opened up in my life have actually been opened on Halloween. Not by choice, but it just kind of happened to be around the day or time we were ready. Both the Marina Cantina in San Carlos, Sonora, Mexico, and Union Public House will celebrate its 14-year anniversary this Friday on Halloween over there. And Halloween also makes me think a lot about being a kid and growing up in Detroit, Michigan. Back in the day, there was always rumors in the 70s and 80s that kids' Halloween candy was somehow tainted with razor blades and needles, if you remember. I remember going to like the 8th Precinct on Grand River Avenue and like having to run our candy through an x-ray machine, like for foreign objects, you know, injected in them in some capacity.
Well, Detroit always kind of had that. As a kid growing up in Tempe, as a young lad, Arizona, Detroit always kind of had the reputation of being a wild Halloween night. At least that's what I remember hearing as a youngster.
So wild and crazy. It wasn't really just Halloween night. It was the night before Halloween, which was affectionately known as Devil's Night. This would be the 30th of October. And what you would do is basically if you had abandoned houses in your neighborhood at that particular time, and given the exodus out of Detroit, there was quite a few abandoned houses, you would choose that time to set that home on fire.
Oh, good
Lord.
Now,
this sounds like an odd family activity to get together and do, but when I was a kid in 1984, I want to say, man, there was 810 residential fires on October 30th alone in Detroit on Devil's Night. Imagine 800 residential fires in one night. They actually would make a curfew, and after 6 p.m. on the 29th and 30th, you were not allowed to be on the streets after, I want to say, 6 p.m., because it gets dark pretty early back then, but just to prevent those fires from Devil's Night over here.
Goodness.
I don't think this has ever come up in southern Arizona in any capacity. You could maybe burn down 24-hour smoke shops or, you know, abandoned strip centers or something along these lines, but it was a real thing growing up in Detroit, Michigan, where I'm from. And of course, Halloween creates a lot of challenges for restaurants as well, too, not just because of the grand openings of a couple of the establishments that we had, but also because our patrons are wearing costumes and masks. When you think about serving somebody alcohol, right?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they're in face paint or a mask. How do you identify people? How do I know whether it's safe to serve you drink number 3 or 4 when you're in a costume over here? It actually creates probably more challenges than just about any other holiday in the entire year because of the costumes.
How do we know you're the same person in the ID card that you just, or the driver's license, whatever you provided for ID? So, yeah.
Correct. We're actually really excited that Halloween this year falls on a weekend, not just because of the Ice Cube song, right? From the movie Friday, but also because we only get one day of Halloween, where that mask and ID thing becomes a real challenge when, say, Halloween hits on, let's say, a Tuesday.
Uh-huh.
Because what happens is the entire weekend before is also Halloween. Friday is Halloween. The Saturday before is Halloween. Sunday is pretty close, so that's also Halloween. And then you get to Halloween proper on, say, that Monday or Tuesday. And by the time it comes around, you've had like 5 or 6 days of Halloween and the mask shenanigans. You're kind of glad to get that one over with.
So I'd argue that Tucson is like months and months of Halloween.
This is
these
true.
Days.
You know, and I think of this station. Chris used to do the scariest convenience store in Tucson episode out there as well, too. I mean, lots to be scared about, of course, in the old Pueblo. But, you know, I'm going to move to a little happier note over here. Arizona basketball season, full swing, right? Those of you that got to see that exhibition game against Embry-Riddle on Monday, we absolutely routed these guys.
113
13-42 was that final score for those keeping track at home. An 80-point victory by the University of Arizona over here. But those days may be short-lived. We're going to get another chance to play basketball on Monday, coming up against defending national champion Florida. Yeah. The Florida Gators are meeting the Wildcats in Las Vegas. That's going to be 5 p.m. this Monday. It's going to be on TNT. Should be a pretty exciting game. One of the most exciting Arizona basketball games we probably had in a while, and that's coming up this Monday at 5 o'clock. So do keep your eyes open for that one, as we're pretty excited to see what the Wildcats are made of. I think it's going to be a little more challenging than the Embry-Riddle team over here. Just saying.
Just a little.
So also on the scary front over here, how about that hatchet attack that happened over at the Jackrabbit Lounge in Tucson on Oracle? I'm a big fan, of course, of the Jackrabbit, and Keith, a former employee and bartender for many, many years at Hotel Congress, and he went on to build his own restaurant and bar called the Jackrabbit Lounge. And a 60-year-old individual went in just a couple of days ago with a hatchet and unprovoked starts swinging the hatchet, smashing the mirrors of the Jackrabbit and attacking three patrons who ended up having to go to the hospital and get stitches. And this, to me, is just terrifying. Like, how many unprovoked hatchet or axe attacks can we seemingly have in the Old Pueblo? How often can this continue to go on? And now it's not just happening at local bus stops, but truly this is happening in one of our local establishments, started by a service industry guy, a really well-known, hospitable, and great place. And to have a hatchet attack like this go on in one of Tucson's noted watering holes is really kind of terrifying.
I'm losing track. How many hatchet attacks has this been? I mean, there's been two on the bus line alone.
Yeah.
There was one out at Udall Park. Well, that was I think that was associated with the bus line. A lot of hatchet attacks. You know, once, twice, I think we can call this a trend, Grant.
Yeah, you know, I'm wondering, like, where are the calls from the Democrat Party for hatchet regulation
Common sense.
You
Common
know, I think there
hatchet.
Might need to be a waiting period before you buy hatchets. I'm not
steel
so sure.
Hatchets, you know, yeah.
Perhaps you could register hatchets, like, with the city, or we could have a hatchet turn-in program, and everybody could burn them down in some capacity. So I've got some great ideas here about what we could do to reduce hatchet violence over here. I mean, I'm going to model it after what we've done for gun violence, because clearly it's the device and not the person.
Senator
right?
Kelly's not doing anything else. He had to grab onto this issue.
I mean, all of their downtime over here, right?
Downtime.
Senator Kelly and Ruben Gallego still receiving their salaries.
Keeping Adelita from starting her job.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to meet with Congressman Juan Ciscomani last week, and we were talking about how he actually is foregoing his congressional salary, right, during this government shutdown period, but that his partners on the Democrat side were not doing that, particularly Ruben Gallego and Mark Kelly, who, of course, have spent most of their time, rather than advocating for the people over here, advocating for Adelita Grijalva still to get sworn in some capacity. And they're seemingly making a big fuss about this one. So House Speaker Mike Johnson has come out and said that at this point, Adelita's got access to the office. She's got phones. She has the opportunity to talk to her constituents. And they're leaving this, like, swear-in part saying that she can't, quote-unquote, do her job. But, of course, with the government shutdown, she's not going to get sworn in and not going to necessarily get paid either way. The staff members of these congressional individuals really may not be getting paid during a government shutdown either way.
Yeah.
And now their excuse is, well, we're not getting the training that we need. We could expose ourselves legally, Adelita said to the press just a couple of days ago. And I think to myself, training, you've been in politics for 30 years. Like, you know exactly what's going on with this one. And on top of that, you could ask, say your entire family
this thing called your entire family.
Right. To even think that without the salary part, not to say that they shouldn't get paid, but to think that you don't have the financial wherewithal to withstand a couple of weeks on this when the ballots were just canvassed in the last 2 weeks, it doesn't make sense to me to just continue this fight and to tie up state money to have our attorney general, of course, sue the federal government in some capacity too, rather than do their job looking out for the best interest of the citizens of the state of Arizona. It's just mystifying.
Grant, there are four. I heard an analysis, there's basically four senators that are stopping this whole thing because they've already gotten a few to cross over. So we're talking four U.S. senators are stopping this whole thing, right? Stopping the whole show. Two of them are here in Arizona. So our two senators basically are 50% of the reason that this logjam can't be busted, okay? The other point is, they are going to be looking at another continuing resolution on November 21st. So what's the big deal? I mean, you pass it now. You have another opportunity to grandstand for your constituents in, what, 3 weeks. So there's another turkey waiting to be consumed 3 weeks down the line. So
without a doubt, this just continues to permeate the news cycles if this is a bigger deal than the government shutdown. And again, I will continue to reiterate that the folks from CD7, the constituency, has been without a vote for the last couple of years.
Indeed.
And so what has truly changed?
And now the public sector unions are all kind of coming around. Unions, including public sector unions, are coming around saying, look, just pass the thing and let's move on.
What I would love to see is our federal government get together in a bipartisan manner and help out the Tucson baseball team. However, they've had to cancel their third home series over here.
Get the employees back to work at the State Department. You know, vote to do this just to save the baseball thing in Tucson.
Absolutely. Come on, we've had to cancel our third home stint this weekend. Right. We were supposed to be playing against Los Mochis, those games are going to be on the road instead. And so the Tucson baseball team just continues to miss out on the best part of the year when the weather is absolutely gorgeous at first pitch at 7 p.m. And I'm incredibly concerned and worried about these guys. As we've talked about before on this show, I'm worried that by the time we get going on the Tucson baseball team, it's going to be December, the last bit of the year, and it's going to be a pretty chilly time to have a first pitch at, say, 7:07 p.m. on December 1st or December 10th. Like, as someone that does an awful lot of outdoor events in St. Philip's Plaza with live music every day, and I'm very cognizant of what the weather looks like at that particular time regularly, like, I'm concerned unless they get together in the Tucson baseball team and start bringing out those patio heaters, you know, we're going to have to share some of these in some capacity. They're going to miss all the best parts
Indeed.
Of the season. And that's really disappointing. So there is a part of the government shutdown that we'd like to see get passed really, really quickly over here in the old Pueblo. Let's get that Tucson baseball team sworn in with some legal documents to be able to play ball out here in the old Pueblo. But speaking of playing ball, we're going to take a quick break over here, and we're going to talk to someone that's playing ball in the city of Tucson. We're going to have Jay Tolkoff, Republican candidate for Ward 6. They've got a little election coming up next week, and we're going to talk about it. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Krueger on 1030 AM The Voice, your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Krueger. You know, I love talking about Tucson, the old Pueblo, Pima County, and certainly I'm a pretty opinionated guy about ways we could do things better. But one of the things that we need to do things better is to actually go out and run for office. Take that risk, right? Put your name out there. It's easy to go open up a business and employ hundreds of people and start your own radio show and be a chatty patty and talk about solutions. But who actually goes out there and runs for office and makes this happen? And right across from me right now in the KVOI studios is somebody that is doing that. A former restaurateur and current City of Tucson, Ward 6, running as a Republican, Mr. Jay Tolkoff. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning, Grant.
Hey, thanks for taking part of your time out on election week to join us in the KVOI studios.
Well, it's always good to see you.
Nice to see your face as well, too. So you got an election coming up on Tuesday, November 4th. That's 6 days from now. It's October 29th.
We all have an election coming up. It's not just me.
This is true. Well, those who live in the city of Tucson. Now, this is a mail-in only election. Is that correct?
Yeah, but that doesn't mean you can't go to your favorite polling place and cast your ballot the traditional way, which is the way I do it. I just kind of like going down there and saying hello to people, and it's just the way I work it.
Is it too late to put your ballots in the mail right now? Do you have to go take them physically now to a polling station or drop-off center?
The literature said the 28th was the last day to mail it in and make sure you get it. But that, you know, you might be able to sneak it in, but if it doesn't get there on time, it doesn't count. So much better off to drop it off in person now.
Understood. And how are you feeling with 6 days left in this election cycle?
You know, you never know. It's like being at the horse races. You pick your winner, and you know, I'm pretty confident that I've got a good chance of making it. I feel a lot more confident today than I did when I decided to run 9 months ago or so. And you know, we'll just see how it works out. You know, one thing that I want to just impress is I run into people all the time and they say, well, you know, it doesn't really matter my vote. It absolutely does. You know, every vote absolutely counts. And Sadie Shaw lost by only a mere 19 votes. And, you know, just think, oh, if I went out one extra day and contacted 20 more people, I could have won. I don't want to be in that situation. I was talking to a guy last night. Interestingly enough, he said I would have voted for you if it were an option. And I go, what do you mean? And he said he couldn't vote for me because he's a Democrat, and he knew his vote wouldn't count if he voted for me. And the confusion is unbelievable out there about how elections work.
Sure, the city election system, which has, you know, been a favorite target of mine in terms of criticism and things that we could and should fix, quite frankly, to have a little better or a little more fair representation, let's just say, citywide over here, has often been, you know, the target of many forms of criticism. But at the end of the day, you've got the entire city is able to vote for you right now, not just residents of Ward 6, right? Yeah. Every single resident in the city of Tucson. And for those that say that Republican candidates have no chance in this. I mean, mathematically speaking, of course, a Republican hasn't won since 2009. But when they did, it was in this exact ward, in Ward 6, the ward that you're running for this upcoming Tuesday.
Yeah, which is interesting because, you bring up the whole thing about Tucson elections. It is intentionally confusing, I think. You know, the people don't understand. It's ward orderly during the primary and in the general, it's at large. And, you know, when can I vote? When can I vote? It is just confusing. And it's interesting to win in Ward 6 the way Steve Kozacik did. And prior to that, 8 years before, was Fred Ronstadt, because there's a margin of 3 Democrats to every 1 Republican in Ward 6. But, you know, as you know, I've maintained all along, I just assumed we weren't voting for a Democrat or a Republican. We were voting for people.
Without a doubt, I would maintain that of the things that I'd like to fix in the Tucson election system, one would be to make it nonpartisan. 2 would be to have it during regular election years. It's always made no sense to me to have Tucson elections on these odd years. We're already running elections from a gubernatorial and presidential cycle on the even years, right? Every 2 years sort of offset. And these are the elections that really get people's blood boiling, that get them really excited. It would be great to have tickets further down the line also contributing at that particular time. As we learned from some of the special elections that the city has run, it cost over $1 million to run an election. Imagine that if we just switched to even years, the city would essentially save $1.2 million every other year. So this would cause a savings of tens of millions of dollars over a couple of decades to a city strapped for cash if we just did these during the even years as well, too. It almost just makes too much sense to me.
You're right. What can I add to that? I was reading a list of reasons why my opponent thinks that we should be voting for Proposition 417. And one of her reasons was, if we don't, we have to have a special election, and that costs between $1 million and $1.5 million. Well, the reality is we're going to have a special election coming up for RTA next. And
in March.
Six elections in 365 days. In this
Think about that expense. And you mentioned Proposition 417. For those that aren't keeping score at home, that's Plan Tucson. I'm sure you've all read the 285-page document that is Plan Tucson, of course. But this is another reason that makes these things, you know, so nefarious, is that here you've got this off-year election outside of gubernatorial or presidential cycles, and you're going to shoehorn this nearly 300-page document across the general public as well, too, who are just going to vote in partisan lines on, in this case, the city council elections, and most likely pass this without having ever read it or really understanding what's inside of it. And then, of course, the city will then have the pretext for the next decade to be like, but this is part of Plan Tucson. Everybody voted for this. You all read it. We all put that in front of you. And I haven't seen hardly a thing about Plan Tucson. If it wasn't for being somewhat plugged in politically and going out of my way to search for this information, would I even know what this is? I have to imagine the general public has no clue of what's inside those 300 pages, no?
Well, that's the modus operandi for our city. And the worst part about Plan Tucson is Plan Tucson is supposed to be the guiding document. And what it really does is it's validate a number of plans and strategies and roadmaps that the city has generated over the last 5 years that we had little or no input in. For instance, Move Tucson, which is the document that is driving all our transportation and mobility. It was crafted in the years 20, let me back up. It was crafted with plenty of public input during the years 2020 and 2021. Well, I don't know about you, but I was kind of going through that whole COVID thing during that period of time. So where did all this public input come in?
Right. And what giant public meetings were you having in 2020 or 2021 exactly. where hundreds of people were getting together closely in a room to discuss these sort of things, right? It's just, to me, it's mystifying to think how we can then call this a public process, right? Because we have some little advertised public meeting at some library deep on the Southwest side somewhere once that nobody saw or knew about and said, well, we had a public meeting and we discussed this. And everybody there was in agreement, and therefore this is now our guiding document for the next decade or two, right? The Bible that we're going to follow. We have carved this thing into stone and is going to be our guiding light. It, to me, is a tremendous, tremendous mistake. And when we get into transit, it just continues to show the problems that we're having here in the Old Pueblo. I want to hold that thought. We move over here to a break. And Jay and I are going to discuss some of the fun of the Tucson transit system and what he might be able to do to fix it if he wins that election this Tuesday, November 4th. Don't go anywhere. Another exciting segment with the city council candidate for Ward 6, Jay Tolkoff, coming up after the break. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. Every weekday, 7 to 9 a.m., five different days, five different voices, giving you a different opinion of view of what's going on over here in the Old Pueblo, what's happening in your city of Tucson, what's happening in Pima County. On Mondays, you've got Lydia Aranda. On Tuesdays, Ted Maxwell from the Southern Arizona Leadership Council bringing you his engagement hour. On Wednesdays, you get me, Grant Kruger, a little food for thought, business development with just a dose of politics. On Thursdays, Tom Moulton from the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance. And on Fridays, Dr. Ed Ackerley bringing you wonders from the University of Arizona. Now, those that are keeping score, we do have an election in the city of Tucson. It's coming up this Tuesday, November 4th. We're going to have a new city council person, no matter what, in Ward 6, because incumbent Karen Ulick was appointed to replace Steve Kozacik, who resigned. And one of the two people running for that seat happens to be right across the way from me over here, Mr. Jay Tolkoff. He's the candidate for Ward 6 from the Republican Party. Welcome back, Jay.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, I've been reading a lot about you in the papers over these last couple of weeks. You're getting a lot of coverage for some support you got from a local Teamsters 104 over here. Tell me about the Teamsters and why they're supporting your candidacy.
Well, the Teamsters traditionally represent warehouse workers and truckers, you know, the people that bring our food to our grocery stores and deliver our products from United Parcel Service, and also are there the operators of the SunTran transit system. And I think we all know that the safety on the transit systems has been in decline for a number of years now. It culminated in a shooting a couple weeks ago. And for at least a year, the Teamsters and the bus drivers have been addressing mayor and council and telling them, we've got real problems here, and it fell on deaf ears, and finally there was enough of an outcry, and it had a lot to do with the Teamsters having a press conference that was well attended, where not only did they announce that they were going to endorse me because I recognized it and went to them almost a year ago and said, why is this happening? And all of a sudden everybody woke up, you know. Nikki Lee's got a plan. Paul Cunningham's got a plan. The mayor came out with her Safe City or Safe Tucson initiative that was, you know, had a full page ad in the newspaper promoting it. And it's just, but the reality is nothing's really changing. And the Teamsters believe that if I get on there, that they'll continually have a voice that's going out to the public. That is going to demand that from our politicians. That and the reality is, as a former employer, I would be embarrassed and ashamed to ask an employee to work in the conditions that they have to work in. And you know, if we want our transit system to be successful, it's got to be safe. It's got to be the type of thing that people feel comfortable getting on. And there are lots of students that are taking Ubers now because they don't feel safe on the buses. And you know, you can sugarcoat it any way you want, but that is the fact. Just get on the bus. Go from downtown out to Tucson Mall and just watch what happens. I've done it, and it's unbelievable.
Without a doubt. And you know, over 98% of the votes from the city council are 7-0, right? They vote almost unanimously on every issue. But there's starting to be a little crack in that armor when we start talking about free transit. And you mentioned councilpersons Lee and Cunningham, who both have expressed some opinions and ideas that maybe we should start to charge for this transit in some capacity. Perhaps there is some merit behind this. If you're elected on Tuesday, you would be potentially the third vote to also charged for transit, or at least look into that possibility?
Well, yeah. And you know what? It's kind of funny because, you know, the other side likes to talk about certain groups of wealthy people paying their fair share. I don't understand why they have a problem with people that can afford to pay for the bus, who can take the bus and save their gas and save the parking fees for going downtown for go to work or wherever. You know, you know the going rate right now is 70 cents a mile, according to the IRS, to operate a motor vehicle. So why shouldn't somebody that's making $50, $60, $70, $100,000, $200,000 a year, what's wrong with making them pay $1.50 or $2? Because that goes to support all the other programs that help out people that can't afford. It's just to make it free, to me, is, you know, overall, you know, it's got to be just free. That's it. It doesn't make any sense. And you know, it costs us $100 million a year for that resource. So I mean, you can't go into the library and borrow a book without showing your ID. Why are we letting people take advantage of a $100 million a year resource without no accountability whatsoever? It makes no sense to me.
I've seen at least $70 million as a line item on the city's budget for the particular buses, and it may be higher. You've certainly got access probably to more information than I do on this one. But the maximum fares we've ever achieved were in 2019. We got a little over $12 million. Mm-hmm. So the buses have always been subsidized. If this was run by the private sector, and you've worked in the private sector, I currently work in the private sector, and you had something that cost you at least $70 million a year, and you only had $12 million in ingresses coming in, that would be gone in a matter of seconds. We've all agreed publicly as a society that there should be public transportation, that we're willing to essentially subsidize this no matter what. So it's always been subsidized. But making it free is basically a subsidy of a subsidy on top of that. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. What would be your plan if you were to bring back fares?
Well, as I said to Tim Steller, you know, I could throw out five or six different options. But I think the thing that you need to do, which I think our city doesn't do a very good job, is let's get the involved parties, get some representatives from the bus drivers and the Teamsters. Let's get the city out there. Let's get some people from TPD. Let's get some people that represent riders. And there are groups that do that for sure. And pull them together and let's come up with a compromise. You know, whether it's just a matter of having an ID card or, I mean, in California, if you want to drive down express lanes, they have this little token in your car that recognizes that's your vehicle and they bill you down the road. You know, that's something we could certainly do. There's any number of things. When I was on the bus, I was amazed at the little machines that, you know, took the fares before, still actually sitting there. And, you know, like, couldn't we bring those back? And people say, oh, well, if you start charging fares, that might cost millions of dollars. Well, not charging fares, it is costing us millions of dollars. And I would love to see that be addressed somehow. It can't go on the way it is.
What was insulting to me, right, was that Councilmember Ulick herself said, well, we couldn't possibly bring back the fares because that would cause more violence against the bus drivers. These are the guys that broke it, right? They took away the fares. Now they're saying, well, we couldn't possibly reinstate it. It would make it more dangerous. So we have to leave it broken in the way that we broke it. That's just insulting.
Right, as if Circle K shouldn't charge for gas or cigarettes or sodas
or
anymore because,
sure.
Yeah, because the person charging would be subject to violence for charging for their goods or services. It makes no sense. Everybody out there is charging for just about everything. And the prices of everything have essentially gone up 30 or 40% in just the last 5 years. And so to think that free is the market price, a dollar might be the new free, quite frankly. Like, that might be okay in some capacity. Like, to think that, like, the prices are of things, goods or services of this are going backwards makes absolutely zero sense to me in the hyperinflationary economy we've seen over the last half a decade.
And Matt alluded to something. Hi, Matt. He alluded to something that was, I see this kind of work that we create a problem, then we declare an emergency, and that gives us the ability to put through all these things without having necessarily public necessary public input. Perfect example is the housing emergency that's now been declared. And one of the things that really, really drives me nuts about our current council is, you know, when I'm being interviewed, it's like, well, what solutions do you offer? Well, when they declare these emergency, usually the motion that's passed is that we're declaring an emergency and we direct staff to come up with solutions. It's like, well, wait a second. You're the elected official. Why don't you give us a solution? I never hear solutions coming from the city council. It always comes from staff. And why isn't that happening? Because we are electing people that can't come up with solutions? Well, we need to really think hard about who we're electing.
Without a doubt. And we're going to get the opportunity to think hard about that. We've got an election coming up this Tuesday in 6 days. There's not even a Republican candidate running in Ward 5. Selena Barajas, by virtue of essentially winning the Democrat primary, is going to be anointed, assuming she has voted for herself. It's kind of over, right? Like, that one is just done. And there is a competitive race in Ward 3, though, as well, too, as incumbent Kevin Dahl is running against J.L. Wittenbraker over there. So we've got three city council seats up this Tuesday, two of which are being contested. One has just been literally turned over and just handed the incumbency. It's going to give us two new city council people, though, because Ward 5, Selena will be new, like it or not, that she is a new person over there. And in Ward 6, where you're running, it's going to be you or Mrs. Schubert. One of the two of you is also going to be new and our new city council person. So I'm pretty excited to see some new faces on there. And I'm hoping that you guys have a really, really solid shot. Why don't we take a quick break over here? We're going to have one more segment with Ward 6 candidate for city council, Mr. Jay Tolkoff, coming up after the break. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger, and we are joined for one more segment by Ward 6 candidate for city council, Mr. Jay Tolkoff. Welcome back, Jay.
Thank you.
Hey, I was noticing in the paper just the other day that there was a planning commission meeting for the city council on October 15th, and they've punted and moved that commission meeting to after this election cycle, all the way to November 12th, I want to say. Like, any idea on why that one moved?
Yeah, but I'm sure I'd be a conspiracy theorist. This is about the whole middle housing thing that is being, the state is telling us we must do it, but Tucson is taking the opportunity to take a relatively small impacted area and exploding it with the plan of going across the whole city, which would open the door. And this is not figuratively speaking, literally, your next door neighbor might decide to chop off part of their land in their backyard and put a couple shipping container homes in the backyard. There's no, this is all about middle housing. Middle housing is the type of housing that is in between a single family residence and an apartment complex. So duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, and density is a good thing if it's done right. But the city of Tucson is not thinking, and they're talking about making this available throughout the city. Right now, it's an area, I want to guess, around 40 square miles. It's a huge area where they're going to take the zoning rules that have existed for years and remove them and allow people to put a lot more residences on properties that normally were for one house before, with no consideration for where the garbage cans are going to go, where the automobiles are going to go, with the standards of construction so that the new housing kind of fits in with the existing neighborhoods. It's a disaster in the making, and they're going full speed ahead. And as I like to say, people will say, oh, well, you're just not being progressive. And it's like, well, progress is a great thing unless you're heading for a cliff, a la the ending scene of Thelma and Louise. At some point, you got to go, this is going the wrong way, and we need to put on the brakes and back up a little bit, and then kind of let's put in the necessary things so that bad things don't happen, like displacing people that have lived in homes for years because they can't afford the new taxes, or gentrification, or, hey, I can't get into my I can't get into my house anymore because I've got 16 garbage cans in front of my property for the properties that are behind me, and there was no place for a dumpster.
Traditionally, Jay, though, HOAs have seemingly had an oversized, you know, voice in the city of Tucson. You would think that this would be a cause that you could get groups like this to rally behind and potentially even protest or want to have their voice heard. Why do you think this has been moved?
Well, first of all, let me just address the HOAs. This will not affect HOAs because they have more restrictive zonings that the city can't overrun or overwrite. The reason I think that it got moved is simply because I had arranged to have several hundred people show up and protest because the staff was ignoring what the public input was, and they were telling the Planning Commission, oh, everybody's in favor of this. That's not what I saw. When I was at a meeting, I saw a lot of people saying, I don't want this, and that was not being reported. So I made arrangements to have hundreds of people show up to Mayor and Council chambers. And 6 hours before the meeting, it's canceled because the city failed to give proper notice. Like, they haven't given notice for generations. How does that even begin to work? So now it's moved after the election.
So win or lose the election, would you still go protest this on the 12th?
Oh, absolutely. And we need people to show up. We absolutely need people to show up.
And so the timing of this aside, I find the timing of so many of the city's actions here to be somewhat questionable. We've seemingly taken a very aggressive approach to enforcing security on the loop over just these last
three visible sweeps or raids, whatever you want to call them, three visible actions, and ballots have been out for 3 weeks. I'm just saying that I'm sure that's just a coincidence.
Yeah, and look, I'm for the security on the loop. Don't get me wrong.
Like, absolutely.
You can't look at
Keith
in the mouth.
Bring
over
more
here. Like,
security.
Yes, continue. But the timing of this, that literally the first raid hit the day ballots were mailed out here. Just to say that that's not a little questionable, that timing is not suspicious in some capacity. I'm maybe not a huge conspiracy theorist over here, but gosh, this one seems to be pretty odd to me. What do you think, Jay?
You know, you can come up with all different kind of things. But I just go back to what I say to people. You know, we all want the same thing. We want to feel safe in our community. We want to feel safe on our buses. We want to drive on decent roads. We want good parks. And our city has not been delivering that. And to go out and reelect the same people to keep doing the same thing, or to elect the people that are being endorsed by the people that are in power right now, to me is just crazy. You know, if things are not working, you want to do more of the same, okay, don't vote for Jay. But if you want to really have somebody that is a critical thinker and has a proven track record of getting things done, then you need to go out and vote for Jay. And you need to go out and vote for Janet also. And every day that I run into people, and it's not just campaigning, I ask them, have you sent in your ballot? And encourage them to do that. Everybody listening right now should be doing the same thing. When you're at the grocery store and you're paying for your food, ask the checkout person, hey, did you fill out your ballot? The turnout is absolutely ridiculous. Rahina Romero essentially won the mayor's race 2 years with less than 10% of the people that live in this town voting for her. That's not democracy.
No, without a doubt. Well, that's a great note, I think, to leave this interview over here. Jay, we really appreciate you taking part of your time on your busy schedule on election week to join us over here on The Morning Voice, and wish you a tremendous amount of luck in your campaign coming up in 6 days over there. Thank you, Jay.
My pleasure.
Hey, and those of you paying attention out there, get out there and vote. Return those ballots. Do pay attention to your city elections. Local elections matter. These are the things that make the big difference in your lives. You may get more excited about the gubernatorial race or who's going to be the president in 3 years, but it is the city council. It is the board of supervisors that make an absolute difference in all of your lives. And I salute everybody out there going to run for those positions as well. Don't go anywhere. We've got an amazing another hour of The Morning Voice coming up after the break on 10:30 a.m. Your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to hour two of The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. I love this time of year in October. There is just so much going on in the hospitality industry. And of course, we always get to talk about openings and new cool things coming to the Old Pueblo, more so than just closings, although we're going to talk about an odd closing too a little later on in the show. But first, on the positive notes over here, news broke just yesterday that Nimbus Beer is returning to Tucson. Nimbus,
wow.
Of course, a former resident of South Tucson, right just around down the corner. Block.
Yeah, right around the corner on 44th, sure.
Very much so. So it was announced yesterday that the Arizona Brewing Company out of Scottsdale is going to begin to contract Nimbus Brewing Company's beer using their original recipes. Now, I, for one, am excited to see Nimbus Beer come back. I like the idea of the Dirty Witta, right? I liked when they were brewing the A1 Pilsner.
Monkey Shine. Like
yes.
The old Monkey Shine.
Very much so. However, Nimbus has been closed since 2018, right? A very, very vicious divorce between Jim and Patricia Counts ended up being the death knell of that business in 2018. It went into receivership. There were all kinds of legal fights about what was going on with Nimbus. I think it took 7 years to get through this legal mess of who owned what and where. And now, of course, the brewing equipment has been long since dormant, auctioned off and gone in pieces. So all we're really going to do is contract brew the old recipes. And I question whether or not you can make that the same. There's a lot to do with brewing that has to do with the environment of where the beer is produced. Both the air and more particularly the water quality makes a huge, huge difference in this. We struggled years ago when I worked for Breckenridge Brewery here in Tucson trying to recapture the Rocky Mountain spring water that made Breckenridge beer so delicious and fresh when replaced with Central Arizona Project's finest aqueduct flow.
Which may have started in Rocky Mountains. Who knows,
yes.
Right? I mean, it could have... You know,
but by the time it got here, it not only rotted out your pipes, but it also, you know, added flavor characteristics that were less than desirable, sure, compared to what we wanted in the Rocky Mountains. And so our brewers at that time literally became chemists. We would have to strip the water of all of its minerals using RO and then add back just the desirable ones that you wanted to have in the process. Similar to what we talked about last year with a pizza maker on here that had this New York water maker.
Oh, Grimaldi's.
Yes, sure. Right. Yeah. There's been a number of places that have tried to replicate that, but beer being, you know, even a larger percent water than pizza dough is even more susceptible to that input good. And so it's going to be interesting to see how closely they can replicate that with different brewing equipment in a different city with different water. But nonetheless, someone's got the rights. And so Nimbus is coming back. And I think I'm pretty excited to see that one happening. What I'm also excited to see was a vote on the city council meeting last week with respect to the historic Fox Theater. A portion of that building, where some of the Brugger's bagels and whatnot was located, they voted on to knock a portion of it down for the expansion of the Fox Theater. The neat part about that was that that part of that building was zoned historic and registered in the National Registry of Historic Places. Now, normally I wouldn't come on the radio and exactly champion us knocking down buildings in the National Registry of Historic Places. But in Tucson, there are a number of properties that have this exact characteristic right now that aren't being developed because of that designation. And so a number of historic preservationists wrote letters to the city of Tucson saying, look, even though we're for historic preservation and this idea, if we don't knock down these parts of the Fox Theater, we're never going to get to this big, new, beautiful future that we can build with this one. And so in spite of, they needed mayor and council's
blessing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so the mayor and council voted, just as they do 98% of the time, 7-0 in this one, to allow for the knocking down of a portion of these historic buildings for the greater good, to make the Fox Theater ultimately the gem that it could and should be downtown. And I, for one, am 100% for this. There are a number of buildings on Broadway. There are a number of buildings downtown that suffer from the same affliction, that it's easy enough to register buildings in the National Registry of Historic Places without even the ownership knowing or approving that you're doing that. And in many cases, buildings like this were registered not by the property owner, but by outside groups doing this sort of work. And this ends up hurting development. And so I think there are other properties, both downtown on this and the Sunshine Mile, that may benefit from this precedent. And I, for one, am excited to see the city take a vote in a positive direction.
So when we do this, because I know sometimes, and I don't know if this instance, but when we do this, I know sometimes if you're a historic building, you get a... you get a deal on your property taxes. So do they keep their deal on their property taxes while they're able to redevelop?
No, sir. You forego the tax credits that you would get, the historic tax credits from using that designation to do so. And so you've got to understand the economic cost-benefit analysis when you're trying to weigh this out. Are these historic tax credits worth it? Or is it so dire and the building is so financially or functionally obsolete that it needs to be eliminated? And if it is, then quite frankly, it might need to be eliminated. Because while certainly there are some buildings that absolutely 100% should totally be preserved, you know, when you're thinking of the Pima County Courthouse building or San Javier Mission or something like this, but when you think of 1950s mid-century strip malls, I don't have as much love in my heart for those particular buildings. I love economic development. I love jobs. I love a vibrant and awesome downtown with cool new developments, with such things as live music and concerts and cultural events that will drive people to go downtown in spite of the parking challenges. And the city of Tucson made a vote forward in the positive direction for that one. So I'm just recognizing them over here. Also, on a positive note, it looks as if the Kingfisher is giving out free meals this Sunday, November 2nd, for furloughed federal government workers. I've seen restaurants all over the country starting to do this as a trend. This is the first one I've seen pop up in Tucson to do so. Jackie Cooter's a great operator. I'm going to have her on the show one of these days over here from the Kingfisher. Her and Ted took this one over about 3 or 4 years ago, around the middle of COVID or so, to keep an old historic Tucson brand kicking on Grant Road, and excited to see them offering free meals this Sunday, November 2nd.
Seeing some of that in Sierra Vista. There was a news story about some restaurants in Sierra Vista are doing the same thing.
Yep. I think that's pretty cool. And so bringing that one up on the radio as well, too. Also pretty cool, Finney's Landing, Doug Finnegal, had a movie made about him. Kabali and the Tiki Obsession premiered last week at the Newport Film Festival. Doug owns both Finney's Landing at Swan and Sunrise and then The Landing on Oracle Road. And behind The Landing, he's got a little tiki bar named Kabali, a cool little speakeasy where he's got over 1,000 tiki mugs. I want to say 1,500, Matt, tiki mugs from his own personal collection that are out there on display behind the bar. So you want to talk about a tiki obsession over here. Like, this guy loved tiki mugs so much that they made a movie about him, and it premiered last week at the Newport Film Festival. So I'm looking forward to figuring out a way to watch that one over here and stream that one. When I figure out how to do it, I'll let you guys know so we can learn about a fellow Tucson restaurateur, Doug Finnegal, and his tiki obsession.
Very cool.
Over at Kabali. Super, super cool. On an odd note, Chow Down Pizza Studio, who's got two locations, right? They're at the 10,500 block on North Oracle in their new restaurant. But their flagship, the one that they opened in 2022 on Dodge, announced that they were closing this week. Now, I find this one to be kind of odd because Chow Down's been a pretty popular sort of pizza experience, right? They do over a couple hundred pizzas. And owner Paul Reyes has been all over social media over this last year or two with sort of restrictions and caveats and asterisks next to his statements. Hey, sorry you had to wait so long for your pizza. You know, we've got 45-minute cook times because the demand is essentially exceeding our ability to produce out of this kitchen. And I understand that, but he's announced that he's closing the pizza studio on Dodge Boulevard because of this. And this, to me, strikes me as odd because, to me, if you were having hundreds of guests so enthralled with your product, why wouldn't you expand your kitchen in some capacity? I get having too small of a kitchen. We took over the space that's now Proof Artisanal Pizza and Pasta. It had been 5 different restaurants, Matt, in 5 years, and they all failed. And one of the reasons was because the kitchen was too small. You see, there's a balance between the size of the kitchen and the number of seats you have in the front of house.
Sure.
It's very easy, particularly in outdoor locations, to just continue to add chairs, right? You can put more and more tables and more chairs out there, like what Chow Down has, like what we have at St. Philip's Plaza. But at some point, if you don't have a big enough kitchen, the analogy is like having a really large pickup truck, but with a 4-cylinder engine.
Yeah.
It's fine if you're driving down the freeway, but if you ask this thing to tow up mountains, you're in real trouble. And that towing up mountains is your Friday and Saturday night from, say, 7 to 9 p.m., 6 to 9 p.m., right? Your peak hours when there's more demand than there is space. And in pizza ovens, there's just a limited number of pizzas you can fit in an oven at a certain time. You can keep adding chairs outside. They had a seating capacity for 200. But the pizza deck is just a certain size. A pizza is a certain circumference, sure. right? With like, there's only so many that can fit in that oven yeah. at a particular time. You've got to adapt in some capacity. What we did at Proof was we built a second expo kitchen because the kitchen was so undersized. We actually added a pizza oven to it so that we had two kitchens so that essentially the pastas and the entrees could come out of one side and the pizza could come out of the other side. And then we made a menu that was 50% pizza and 50% pasta so that there would be a balance in the demand on the kitchen. In this case, they've announced that they're just closing Chow Down, and they're going to retool
both
it.
Both locations are
no,
or just
the one
on
Dodge.
They're
gotcha. Keeping the one in the former Witch location on North Oracle. Okay. It still doesn't even have a sign yet that says Chow Down. It's got wow. the old Witch sign on in front of it, at least as of a few weeks ago when I went by. And so they're going to close this one down and turn it into a nacho concept, a concept forged only on nachos, which I'm sure you can put out faster. And I get the idea, but why would you just abandon Chow Down? I would leave the pizzas and then also build a second kitchen that had the nachos and figure out some balance. Just like we did at Proof, I feel like this would be the proper solution to help make your customers happy and offer some balance in customer demand. Or you could also just raise your prices too. And at some point, there will just not be as much demand, and you'll reach an equilibrium balance as well, too. So really interesting news over there. I'll have to see if I can get Paul on the show, and we'll talk about that one at some point, because I'm kind of sad to see that Chow Down on Dodge close. That was a pretty popular place, and I had a lot of guests talk about how great the pizza was over there. But you can still get that great pizza at the 10565 North Oracle is where they're located. So pretty excited about that one as well, too. And then also, the Old Pueblo Club announced their soft opening last night. The Old Pueblo Club's a speakeasy. It's located in the new Sonoran House property. So that's, again, Tucson and 6th Avenue. So they had their soft opening for a really cool cocktail speakeasy behind the joint last night. I had an invitation. I did not get a chance to go because of this whole work thing cuts sometimes into my ability to have craft cocktails in the middle of the evening. But I will and certainly get a chance to go in the next week or two and check that one out. So do be on the lookout for a cool new speakeasy, the Old Pueblo Club, located where Sonoran House is at 6th and
Tucson. I know the place.
We're going to take a quick break over here for some great local sponsors. When we come back, too, we should have a local Tucson restaurateur, David Matias, on. His family owns it, or he owns, a Victoria Cocina Mexicana. Looking forward to an amazing interview with David Matias coming up soon as well. You're listening to Grant Kruger on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. Breaking restaurant news over here. On 4th Avenue, the former Mono's location has announced that they're going to have new tenants popping in. They're going to be a restaurant called Next, and they're also going to have a speakeasy called Afterlife. And so that just broke. It's in the Daily Star this morning. You can read all about that one. So the former Mono's location on 4th Avenue, having a new concept go in to fill that one. Love it. That was a really cool spot, and we were really sad to see Mono's go. But we are joined right now in the KVOI studios by a dynamic restaurateur with a long family history of serving amazing Mexican food in Tucson, Mr. David Matias. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thanks so much for joining us on The Morning Voice today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We just celebrated a little over a year, your anniversary, right, of Victoria Cocina Mexicana?
That's right. We celebrated our one-year anniversary in September.
Amazing. So how does it feel to have survived your first Tucson summer, my friend?
I'm going to tell you the truth. I feel like I went 15 rounds with Muhammad Ali.
Understood. How did you do in those rounds? At least you went the rounds. You didn't get knocked out in the first round, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know what? It was one of those things that we're just happy we didn't get knocked out and we're still here. But yeah, it was tough, but we're here.
I love it. Hey, so you started pretty young in the restaurant business. Can you give us a rundown of your history in the restaurant business? How'd you get started?
Well, my first day ever working with my parents, my mom actually sent me home. We were like about a couple hours into my shift. I was bussing tables and she was just like, we're too busy and you know, you're not keeping up.
You got fired on your first shift by your mom.
I did. But it was a fantastic lesson learned. You know, I walked home and I was like, you know, it was hot. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go back to work tomorrow. I'm not going to let this beat me. So, yeah, I went back to work. I had a different mentality. And that's just the way it's always been with me. Like, you know, I always get, you know, it's always, everything's always pretty hard because I'm not like the smartest or the most talented person in the world, but you know, I do my best and it ends up working out okay.
So I find that some of the most successful restaurateurs often started from the bottom in some capacity, right? Like your first job was bussing tables.
My first job was bussing tables. I started waiting a few tables because, you know, we were just busy and my mom was always, and my dad was always like, you know, we need more help. We need more help. And it was just always the kids, you know, I have two brothers and sisters and they were like, you know, well, they're here. Might as well use them. So, you know, it was, now you've had a few weeks of bussing tables. You seem like you got it. Now go wait some tables.
And, go with God, my friend. Yeah, you are ready to go. Like you got this.
Yeah. So, you know, there was a time there at Teresa's where it was just me and my dad. And you know, I was 15 years old, so I couldn't run the beer or the margarita. So I would take the order, run the food, everything, and my dad would take the drinks out for me. So, yeah.
I love it. A true family business.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, you guys ended up getting to open a couple other Teresa's Mosaic Cafes, right? Because there's Mosaic Cafe Dos as well, too, across in the Foothills Mall. Tell me about that.
My sister owns Mosaic Dos. I think she's been up there about close to 20 years now. So she's doing really well. She's doing very, very, very well. And, you know, she's over there, you know, making it happen over there on Mosaic Dos, and she's still making the fresh home tortillas, flour tortillas. And, you know, her menu is the same menu as my mom's menu is. So she's doing really, really well over there.
And there was another family one in California as well, too, for a number of years.
My brother, Isaac, he opened up Teresa's Mosaic Cafe in El Segundo. And, you know, but he decided to come here and help my mom, you know, and my dad, because, you know, my sister's doing those. I'm doing Victoria, and, you know, it's just something that we all wanted to make sure that it was still taken care of. And I think Isaac is doing a fantastic job. You know, he knows what he's doing. So, you know, I think I left it in good hands.
Tell me about the family dynamic of running a restaurant over here. Your son Damien's here with you right now as well, too, in the studio. Yeah. So this is a real family business. Let's talk about those challenges. Is that hard?
It's hard to establish who's in charge. Especially when you have very stubborn kids. But the problem that I have is that Damien is fantastic and very talented. He's probably one of the best pastry chefs here in Tucson. He's 18 years old. He wants to go to Culinary Institute of America like his dad did.
Yeah, you're a CIA graduate. That's not the Central Intelligence Agency. In the culinary world, CIA is probably more important than us. The Culinary Institute of America.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, we're very excited for him. Problem is that I don't really know how to do what he does in his level, so it's hard for me to, you know, go over there and tell him, you know, what about this and what about that, because he just kind of gives me that look of like, you know, I know what I'm doing.
Hey, pastries are, I mean, baking is a tough business, right? They always said cooking is an art and baking is the science.
There's
something to be said for that.
Yeah, you know? It is, you know, and he's a really smart kid, and he graduated from South Point, you know, and he knows math and he knows his, you know, everything that he needs to do, because like that stuff, and he's got patience, because I don't have patience for that. You know, I'm like, let's go, hurry up. You know, why is this not getting done yet? And it's just one of those things, like even just letting the bread proof, I don't have patience for that.
No, he's got a couple of beautiful pieces over here. Brought some pan del muerto, and it looks like a pumpkin concha as well, too. Tell me about the pieces he made over here.
Well, right now, because Friday is Halloween, you know, he wanted to do a pumpkin concha, because we usually serve the regular conchas at the restaurant, and also some cochitos. But because of the whole month that we're celebrating, the Dia de los Muertos, we have drink specials, we have pan de muerto. He wanted to make those. And those were things like, you know, I never thought that I'd be selling in my restaurant. You know, I have a fantastic pastry chef, and he's like, let's do it, Dad. And I said, all right, let's go for it. You know, I don't have, I don't like flan, and I don't like creme brulees, anything like that. But we have one on our menu now because of the one that he made. On Mother's Day, he comes up to me and he goes, what do you want for special for dessert? And I go, well, ask your mom. You know, she's a part of the business too. She's helped me open the restaurant, and she's a big part of the restaurant. Hi, CJ, I love you. And she's like, you know, ask your mom what you want for special. And he said a creme brulee. And I was like, okay, if that's what you want to do, just let me know after it's all done. So he made it and he serves it to me. And I was like, wow, I was blown away. I looked at Claudia and I said, we need to put this on the menu right away.
I love it. Yeah. Keep it in the family over there. Damien's already coming up with awesome dishes over there at Victoria. Yeah. We're going to have to take a quick break over here and hear for some great local sponsors. When we come back, I want to talk to you about your new restaurant, Victoria Cocina Mexicana. You've just celebrated your first year in business after 20 years of working for your folks. So it's got to feel pretty good to get out there and spread your wings and grow as a restaurateur. So we're going to talk about where you're located, that selection choice, and all kinds of neat things about David's new restaurant, Victoria Cocina Mexicana. They're doing Oaxacan food, which is a little bit different than your standard Sonoran fare. Don't go anywhere. We've got more of The Morning Voice with Grant Kruger and David Matias coming up after the break. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. You know, I love small business and I love restaurants and I love stories where people have started from the absolute bottom to create their dream and live out their entrepreneurial spirit. And nobody more embodies that than the man standing right across from me right now in the KVOI studios, Mr. David Matias from Victoria Cocina Mexicana. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hey, so you opened up just a little over a year ago. Break it down for our listeners. Where is that location at?
We're at 7090 North Oracle Road. It's in the Safeway Shopping Center there.
And so that's the location. I believe it was formerly a China Phoenix restaurant.
It was a China Phoenix restaurant. Yeah, I met the owner. He was a really nice guy. It was really funny. He said, I asked him, I go, why are you closing? He says, my wife's making me close. And I go, that's funny. My wife's making me open. They must know each other.
Right. It's funny how wives often drive decisions like this one as well.
Yeah, yeah.
How is it like opening up your own restaurant with your wife as well, too, who's been instrumental in the design on this one? And tread carefully because she might be listening.
I hope she's listening. But no, at the end of the day, you know, I think I knew I could open up a restaurant and be successful. But I told Claudia, I go, I knew I could open up a great restaurant with her next to me. So, and I think that's what it worked. You know, she gives me the opportunity to be in the back and do exactly what I need to do in the back and cook the food that I want to do and make sure that everything's on point and we're doing everything right. And she makes sure that everything in the front, you know, looks nice and everything is where it needs to be, like for the waiters and everything, for them to be able to serve and do a great job themselves. So, and the restaurant is a beautiful restaurant. The bar is a beautiful bar. We're serving fantastic drinks in the bar. But, you know, it all comes together. You know, I can cook, you know, great food, but it won't matter if it's not a great environment. And I think we did that. I'm glad they did that. She did a great job.
So it always starts in the bar, right, with drinks in some capacity. And we love when you, our guests, go out there and order drinks. But you brought a couple of beverages over here with me right now. Tell me what you brought in the studio.
We have a fantastic Café de Olla that we serve. It's very simple, but it's more of the Oaxaqueño traditional way to serve the Café de Olla. And then we have the fantastic, very famous Chocolate Oaxaqueño that we serve at Victoria. It's actually the same chocolate that my mom does, because my mom makes the chocolate, and she puts some on the side for me, and she puts some on the side for my sister, and she puts some on the side for herself. So yeah, it's a fantastic chocolate recipe.
Delicious. Looking forward to giving this one a try over here. I'm enjoying the Café de la Olla right now. Mm. It's a little better than the stuff we're serving in KVOI over here, Matt. We need to up our game a bit, I think, after having this.
Well, I will give it a try. I'm enjoying some of the combat coffee we're serving, and I will try some of the Café de la Olla. It looks very good.
No, it's great.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm excited for Combat Coffee. They're going to come in actually on, I believe, the 12th of November, and we're going to have them talk about their product as well.
Oh, that's cool.
So I know they're going to start sponsoring us over here and working with us, which I'm also excited to have Combat Coffee over here. But getting back to that bar, you're a Oaxacan Mexican restaurant. Oaxaca is the heart of mezcal production in Mexico. Tell me about some cool products you got at your bar.
Well, we have some very unique items. In fact, we were very specific that all of the mezcalas that we serve at Victoria's gives back to the community of Oaxaca. So, you know, they're very special to us, and they're very nice, to tell you the truth. Like, the mezcalas that we serve are very unique. We actually have one, a Firme mezcal right now, that's actually marigold and orange infused. So we make a mojito. We call it a mojadito. And we make a mojito out of it, and it's very good with the smokiness and the sweetness of the marigolds and the orange. It combines really nice. We have a Perro de San Juan mezcal, and it's actually dyed red with the agave worms. So it's dyed naturally red, and we make a drink called a Chapulín Colorado, and we actually serve it with the roasted grasshoppers.
I love it. You don't see a lot of chapulín asado, you know, here in Tucson, even though in southern Mexico, it's very traditional, right? You go to Mexico City and you order a guacamole and like there's chapulín asado on there. And I don't think we could ever pull that off in Tucson. I love the fact that you're bringing that level of authenticity to your restaurant here.
Well, right now we serve tlayudas, which is the big corn tortillas that are grilled. And we serve it with either our Oaxaqueño black bean paste or the mole, and we're serving it with fresh avocados and tomatoes and the traditional way. And you can get that with the lomo adobado, the pork loin, or the homemade chorizo. Or if you're feeling adventurous, you can actually order it with the chapulines.
Wow, super cool. That's really authentic over there. People talk about authentic Mexican food, and I've always hated the word authentic, I think, because most people don't really know what authenticity is, particularly when it comes to southern Mexico cuisine. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the difference between Oaxacan and Sonoran Mexican foods for our listeners?
Well, you know, in the Oaxacan, you know, flavors, you have a lot of earthy, more flavors, like even just the oregano. The oregano here in the Sonora or even here in the United States, a little bit more lemony. And the oregano in Oaxaca is a little bit more earthy. So there's a little bit difference in that, but it makes a huge difference when you're cooking with it, because after you're adding heat to it, the burstness of the earthiness comes out in it. But we're talking about a lot of corn. You know, we don't serve flour tortillas at our restaurant, only for the burros. So we only get the big flour tortillas, and we're actually kind of lucky because my mom usually brings them to me.
Does she make those buns?
She makes them.
Amazing. Yeah. At Teresa's Mosaic Cafe. That's super cool.
So but it's kind of hard though when, you know, she's busy and she calls me and she's like, I'm not going to be able to bring your tortillas. And I'm like, I don't want to have to call my sister because.
Right. I get it. There's some challenges there. What do you say to mom when she misses the tortilla delivery over here? Oh my goodness.
So it's funny because I called out sick one day when I was working for her, and she came to my house and she's like, are you sick? She checked my temperature and I was like, yes, mom. So now, but I wish I could do that with her when I'm like, where's my tortillas?
I'm going to do a little temperature check over here. I'm not so sure about this. Oh man. These are the challenges of family businesses though, right, David?
You know what? I think having family businesses and being, having that support, you know, I think it helps tremendously more than it is a hinder, because like you have people that can help you out when you're in a rut. You know, I can call my brother, I can call my sister, I can call my mom, I can call my dad, which I do more often than I want to. But yeah, I call them up and they're like, you know, what do you need or what can we do? You know, I remember our first, we had a catering job at the restaurant at Victoria's. And it was funny because it was like about 70 people and it was the first one at Victoria's, and my mom and dad were there and they were helping to serve food. It was really cool.
I love that. Really cool, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. And when you can tap into that labor pool like that in some capacity, some savings over there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it costs something later on.
Oh, there's always a cost. Nothing in life is free, my friend. Yeah. Nothing in life is free. So you've just celebrated your first year in business over there. You excited for restaurant season to be coming up now that it's October? You seeing the winds of change already blowing through Victoria?
Oh, yeah. You know, like I said, our first year, we got our butts kicked. But you can tell that more people know about us, and you can see that there's more people coming in through the door, and it's exciting. You know, we want to introduce Tucson to a new type of cuisine, which is the Oaxaqueño cuisine, you know, black bean paste. We have three different moles that we serve at Victoria's. We serve mole verde, mole rojo, and obviously the traditional mole negro, all made in-house. We serve chile nogada, and my chile nogada actually makes me very proud, because I've had a few people that say to me, you know, I've eaten chiles and nogadas, I've eaten chile nogadas in Mexico City, and this one just has a different level to it and tastes a little, it has something in it that we really, really enjoy. I'm very proud of my chile nogada because just inside the stuffing of it, I have about 17 different ingredients in it.
Wow, that sounds very complex.
It is, you know, and then with the sauce, we serve it in the traditional way with the cold walnut sauce on top. Uh-huh. So, you know, there's a lot of complexity in it. And then the chili poblano, you know, that chili poblano is a bigger chili, more meatier. So when you bite into it, there's just a lot of things. Every bite is different. And it's just like a lot, very complex. There's a lot of different levels to it.
without a doubt, one of my favorite Mexican dishes, indeed, particularly in the winter. You know, like it's just so warm and spicy and complex. Like I really love a great chili en nogada.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's definitely one. What other dishes do you recommend guests order over at Victoria's if they want to go check it out? What's your go-tos?
We have a very, like, something I don't think anybody else serves here in Tucson is costillas en tomatadas. It's a
ribs in like a tomato sauce.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like it's fantastic. Spicy, it's salty. The ribs are braised. They're pork ribs, and you know they've been braising for hours. So you know when you get them, you know they fall off the bone.
Love it. Looking forward to trying some of that cuisine for sure. Why don't we take a quick break over here, hear from a couple local radio sponsors, those that help promote AM radio and keep us on the air over here. We've got one more segment coming up with David Matias. He's the owner of Victoria Cocina Mexicana. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant and David on 1030 AM, The Voice, your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to the final segment of The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. It is October 29th. It is high restaurant season in Tucson, and we are lucky enough to be joined by Mr. David Matias. He's the owner of Victoria Cocina Mexicana, taking time out of his Wednesday to come hang with us and talk about opening up his own restaurant. Welcome back, David.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hey, so you finished year one over here. We're excited for October to come. Like, you guys think you'd ever open another restaurant? We've got Teresa's Mosaic Cafe. We've got Teresa's Mosaic Cafe Dos. Could there ever be a Victoria Dos?
Well, that's a question for Damien, my son, because if you're asking me, I'm spent.
It's not an easy feat opening up your own restaurant. No, I mean, this is a real grind. Even after decades of working for your folks, how big of a challenge was this?
It was a tremendous challenge. You know, it was just, you know, all these licenses and all these certificates and all these other things that you need to do just to, you know, ask permission to find a building and all that stuff. Just finding a building itself too was difficult. But, you know, it was one thing after the other. But at the end of the day, I think it was a good decision that we made. And, you know, we're really happy that what we're doing, we're excited for what we're doing, and we're proud of what all the food that we're making at Victoria's.
No, you're making delicious Oaxacan cuisine, and it's substantively different than Sonoran cuisine. And you brought a couple dishes over here with you. Tell me about what you brought in studio over here, because Matt and I are just sort of salivating looking at this. Why don't you break down what we got?
Well, we have our, everybody knows that at Teresa Mosaic Cafe, the huevos rancheros are super popular. And but this is my other version of a huevos rancheros. It's a huevos rancheros, but on top of it is another tostada with beans and salsa verde. And then we top it with carnitas, and we call it huevos guerreros.
I love it.
Yeah. And then we have a sweet potato flautas, and it's on top of our black bean paste, our spicy black bean paste. And then on top is the salsa de aguacate, and then our Victoria's House white rice, Oaxacan white rice.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. This looks delicious. I know it's radio over there, so most of our listeners can't see this, but there is some delicious looking food over here at Victoria. And you've got your son working for you now as well, too, kind of growing up in your footsteps. Like, you started at 13. When did Damien start working for you?
He started at 13. You know, I told his mom that... when I started, I was 13, so he can start. And he went to Teresa's. He actually started at Teresa's. He was a busboy at Teresa's. Yeah, so he started real young, and he was there cleaning tables. And, yeah, it was not actually fun watching him do his thing. Didn't know what...
I think it's actually great at an early age to get the opportunity to start working and to learn the value of a dollar. I worry so much, David, that in today's world with where we're at, like at the really high minimum wage, that it eliminates so many of these starter jobs for our youth. And there's so much character that can be developed in working early and understanding that. I'm not talking about kids working 40 or 50 or 60 hours a week. Like, I get that school is more important, but having a job, even a day or two a week, is actually really meaningful, I think, to our youth development, and something I worry about that we're missing. What do you think about that?
I think it's super important. You know, having a couple dollars in your pocket, it's very important for you to know how to, you know, how much does a chocolate bar cost, you know, and I want to go buy one. Do I have enough? It's those things that are important. But what I think is more important is just communicating, being able to be in front of somebody and saying, you know, how are you today? Can I get you this? Can I get you that? Because, you know, you have to do that every day in life. And it's just like during that COVID section, my kids were at home at school, so they didn't have that. They weren't communicating with people. And you have to have that. as human beings, you have to be able to say hello to somebody. How are you? You know, get a hug every once in a while.
I get it. And I understand we're older and we're going to now sit back and always look at the younger generation and be like, they had it so easy. It's so different. Mm-hmm. I had to walk uphill to school both ways in the snow barefoot, right? Every generation says that. But I do think there's something to be said about having our COVID generation miss an entire 2 or 3 years of mm-hmm. interpersonal development, right? Yeah, yeah. The real world doesn't happen on Zoom. Victoria Cocina Mexicana can't happen in teleconferencing. It comes from you being there every day, grinding out authentic Oaxacan dishes.
Yeah, and it's important. You know, it's important to go out there and just to simply ask, how's everything? You know, because somebody might just say, you know, I didn't like it, you know, or I thought it was great, you know, but you won't know these things if you're not out there asking these questions and just saying, hello, how are you? You know, was everything okay? Is there anything else I can get for you? What can I do to make your experience better?
No, and I love when our guests tell us, even when they tell us things they don't like, because they're actually doing us a favor, right? I'm never worried about a guest saying, hey, you know what? My soup was too spicy or my sandwich wasn't to my liking. I'm deathly terrified of the table that says, oh, everything was fine. Mm-hmm. And they want to be non-conflictive and they leave a 20% tip and walk out the door and then say, eh, honey, that wasn't that good. Yeah. We're just never coming back there because we have no opportunity to fix it, right?
Of course, you know, and especially my restaurant is a little bit more unique from all the other restaurants here in Tucson. You know, we're more Oaxaqueño-based than Sonoran. So when people come, they're like, where's the menudo? And, you know, I come from a restaurant where menudo is like the number one seller. And I'm just like, I just don't sell that. And the reason for that is because, you know, menudo is minuscule in the culinary of Mexico. And Mexico culinary is huge. So that's what I want to introduce to people. We just aren't menudo and crispy tacos. We're pozole. We're carnitas, we're moles, three different moles, we're chile rellenos, two different types of chile rellenos, we're clayudas. What's a clayuda? Well, let me bring you one and you'll see it.
I love it. I think that's fantastic. And our listeners should definitely go out there and check out Victoria. We only got a minute or so left in the segment. David, break down where our listeners can engage with you and your restaurant.
We're Victoria Cocina Mexicana on Aina and Oracle. Our phone number is 520-395-2843. You can call and make reservations. You can find us on all the social medias, Instagram, Facebook. You can place an order at www.victoriacocinamexicana.com. You will get a cramp trying to type that in, but if you do it, you'll get fantastic food.
Amazing. And your operating hours?
We're from 8 to 8 Tuesday to Sunday.
So you're closed on Mondays and 8 to 8. Monday. You're open for breakfast early then as well, too. Breakfast. We've got this great egg dish over here that Matt and I are really excited to tear into after the break. David, I want to say a big thank you to you for taking time out of your Wednesday to come join us here on The Morning Voice.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having us. Gracias.
We're really excited. Listeners, go out there and check out David and Damien's great new restaurant. They've just celebrated their first year anniversary. We can't wait to have them back on the show and talk about when they've been there for a decade or two, or have a Victoria Cocina Mexicana dose. Looking forward to it. Thank you, listeners, for spending part of your Wednesday with us as well. Don't go anywhere. Kathleen Wynn coming up after the break. It's been an absolute pleasure. Looking forward to The Morning Voice next week with you in a little post-election breakdown. We're going to have former city councilman Rodney Glassman's going to be on with me, and we're going to talk about his run for attorney general and break down those city council races. Thanks for spending part of your Wednesday with us.